But all us prisoners realised it would not be a good thing to go pouring down the road because they might think that there was a major escape going on. And so eventually the poor buffalo was brought back and was dispatched. I think it was by one of our petty officers who said that he said he'd do it, and he took the rifle and shot him, you see. So anyway, so that was a little bit of light relief. And
stop you just there. Graham Allen, end of reel 5.
Well, I was going to say, it might be an idea to leave it there, I don't know, but...
Graham Allen, reel 6. So, you've just told us the incident about the buffalo, but, I mean, that was obviously one of the lighter moments, wasn't it? How unremitting was it?
Well, in that particular camp, things gradually got worse and worse from the point of view of hygiene and comfort. The actual conditions under which we were living were very, very primitive, but the control by the Japanese was comparatively relaxed, which was a good thing. However, there was always this... you might say, undertone of serious menace. They got very excited on one occasion, I remember, when we had to dig. They thought there was going to be some kind of air raid. They had some forewarning. And we had to dig air raid trenches. And one evening, three or four Liberator bombers came over, didn't drop any bombs, but they roared over the camp very low, causing extreme excitement among the prisoners, as you can imagine, to see within almost, you might say, arm's length, one's allies up there who were going back home to about their quarters and their dinner. But of course the Japanese were very upset about it, and there was a period of repression. But in the end, after about 9 months in Pomala, I cannot remember exactly, it was decided that we were really quite unproductive from the point of view of doing anything useful for them. And we were shipped back to Makassar, where we were reunited with the camp commandant, or who we called Goldtooth, name of Yoshida, who was this, I may have mentioned before, was the sadist in charge of us all. Actually, he regarded us as his personal property and was very upset to think that we hadn't been looked after properly when they were away from him. And so there was a period of better rations for a week or so, till we were once again absorbed into the general group of prisoners. Soon after that, we, all officers except I think two and the chaplain who were left behind, all officers were moved away from Makassar, put in a ship, and we didn't know where we were going. We soon found out we were not going to the north, as we were afraid. We were afraid we might, but we were being sent south to Java. And after a very uncomfortable journey, battened down in the hold of a cargo ship, we reached Batavia, as it then was, and finished and were moved into a camp in the Jakarta, as it now is, called the Cycle Camp. This was why it was called this, I don't know, but it was an old Dutch army barracks.
Did you have any idea where you were going?
No, we didn't, but as they were, many of us were ex-Navy, it didn't take very much, just a glimpse of where the sun was moving to, and what it was a clear enough indication that we weren't going south. But certainly any trip in a Japanese ship at that time was obviously extremely hazardous, though not as hazardous then as it became later. I mean, when we went to Pomala, Pomala had an iron ore mine, so we went there in the hold of a ship which was complete, which was empty, but had iron ore in it, And so obviously the hold was extremely red and dusty and filthy to be in. On the way back, we came back on top of a cargo of iron ore, and we were even dirtier. The hygiene arrangements and that sort of thing don't bear discussing. But of course, our main fear was not the dirt, it was the fact that any moment that we thought, you know, we could be torpedoed, which happened later on to some of our friends. In Batavia, there were a large number of British and American and Dutch officers, and the camp was under the control of a Lieutenant Maury, if I remember right, who was an extraordinary, another sadist, who we think had his periods of madness controlled by the phases of the moon, because he every now and again would seem to go berserk, and he would go around the camp with a large club looking for trouble. So it was, ludicrously enough, of course, it was soon discovered the best place to be when he was doing this was behind him. So you'd often find quite a large group of people creeping around the camp, checking to see where he was and going where he had been. Though, of course, this was not a good strategy sometimes, because he was very so unpredictable, and people got very badly beaten up by him.
What sort of a man was he to look at?
Oh, he's very short and Japanese, and I believe he went around with his sword, if I remember right. Altogether, you know, you might say, to us, prejudiced at the time, the very epitome of a little Jap. Of course, we always referred to them as the Nips, though not, of course, within their hearing. In that particular camp, we lived in what I think were non-commissioned officers' quarters, consisting of a long hut with the floor raised about 2 feet above the earth surrounding. The floor was concrete, and the interior of the hut had a long passage down the middle and cubicles on either side. From the cubicles, there was a small window looking out. The comfort, it was fairly comfortable in that one could make it comfortable, and it was, how can I put it, we made it as comfortable as possible, but of course there was always the likelihood of a Japanese suddenly turning up, some guard, and walking through the whole place looking for things which he didn't approve of. And of course, if that happened, everybody had to spring to attention and shout out a salute, which was the Japanese for that we soon learned. If I remember right, the Japanese for attention was kiyotsuke, and the Japanese for salute was kirei. If you didn't have a hat on, you were supposed to bow. This, when you were on parade, was screamed out by a Japanese, so it was absolutely impossible to distinguish one from the other, but you just had to get the gist, you see. You knew it. If you were not at attention, you the first roar of kya was what was kyotsuke, and the next one was kya, which was kire. It was in that particular camp that a friend of mine and I discovered the camp radio. Now, as you can imagine, the news from outside was absolutely vital, and we had two signals officers, two young signals officers, two army officers and lieutenants. Very quiet lads, wouldn't think much of them, just young officers. And they were the ones who had the radio. Now, I should explain that I was a very junior officer at the time, and when any information was to be imparted to us, we were always told not to discuss it, weren't told when it arrived or how it came, and we were not told anything about how it was obtained. So that if we were interrogated or beaten up by the Japs, we literally wouldn't have any information to give them. So that suited us very well, because obviously we didn't want to know. So our senior officer would tell us that that there had been a battle, shall we say, at Midway or whatever, and what the results were. We also got information, I might say, from the Japanese. There was a Japanese newspaper in English, the Nippon Times, which gave a slightly more slanted view of the war. However, on one occasion, I'd say we lived in these huts. We had a cubicle. And there was a veranda on either side of the huts where you could sit outside just outside the cubicles. Well, one day, to make ourselves useful, another chap and I, who was another midshipman, decided we would clean down one of these verandas by just clearing up the homemade furniture and sweeping it all down and washing it out and generally putting it all just to make things more tidy. So we worked our way down the veranda, and I got to the end, which was a secluded end, and I picked up a homemade stool, a four-legged stool, about 18 inches by 6 inches. And as I picked it up, I realized that the bottom of it was solid. It was a box, and the side pieces of the stool hid this box. And I realized at once that this must be a radio. At that moment, a face appeared at the window of the cubicle next door, and a flight lieutenant, who was an older man, I think his name was Stillingfleet, very nice chap, and his face appeared at the window, and he said, "Be careful with that stool, old boy." And I carefully put it down and swept round it. But at that moment, I knew this was some information which I didn't really want to have, you see. But, however, apropos of radio communications, which were, I say, most ingeniously devised, the radio gradually, as was rebuilt, smaller and smaller and smaller, until in the end, it was contained in a pair of wooden clogs, such as the ones you're wearing. The wooden clogs were carved by hand, as all of them were, so it looked exactly like any other pair of clogs. There was a bit of rubber tire on the bottom. There was a heel, and there was a rubber tire as a strap across the top. But the rubber soles and rubber heels were removable, and inside one heel was an earpiece. Inside another was the radio, in another was a small transformer, and this could be hitched up to the electric light and get some power obtained, and they could receive broadcasts from Southeast Asia. So it was a most remarkable device in the end, and I think it's in the War Museum now, but it could be used, you see, in times of crisis. If there was a surge, you just put these on and walk in them, because they could be used. And it was, the sort of thing which wouldn't attract any attention at all. So it was really a most remarkable achievement. And I don't know whether these two young officers, these two signals officers who devised it all, ever received a medal for it, but they certainly should have done, because they were risking their lives every day. I mean, it was continuous courage under very stressful conditions.
What, can you remember any of the news you got? The news would just filter out to you.
It would just filter out. I don't really remember the details now, except of course that we gradually learned, that the Americans were hopping from island to island, but we didn't appreciate the logistics, the problem, the enormous distances, and the fact that it was such a bloody business, except we did hear that about Iwo Jima being eventually taken with, I think, about 2 Japanese prisoners and 50,000.
Was it a morale booster?
Oh, yes, it was. It certainly was a morale booster. I mean, it was great to know that, the Japs were being beaten back, of course. And how much the Japs knew at the time, very difficult to say. Probably not very much. Probably not as much as we did. Certainly, they had no idea of the odds against them. The Japs, we did, had no idea, of course, of the... I think it was Admiral Yamamoto who was eventually killed by the Americans hitting his plane. He knew right from the start that Japs had never chance, but his duty was to plan the attack and carry it out, which he did very well.
What sort of quality of person were the guards and the prison staff? I mean, were they ones who were not fit for combat?
Yes, I think on the whole they were. You see, you had... we very seldom saw Japanese officers. As time went on, fewer, less and less occasions. In the very early days, the Japs in charge were serving soldiers or marines, because the Celebes, when we first went to, were actually captured, I think, by the Japanese Navy. But down in Java, it was run by the army. And they used as prison guards Koreans. Now, the Koreans were, to us, extremely nasty bits of work, because they were resentful of their position under the Japanese and were not at all sympathetic to us. And really, they produced some extremely unpleasant sadists and types. On the other hand, they also had some conscripts from other parts of, Eastern Asia, including, and one got to know one or two, some of them, moderately well, and one had a good idea of what their characters were like. So if there was a working party in which, and one was in charge of, or two or three officers were in charge, then one's duty was, of course, to keep the Japanese in conversation so that they didn't notice how much or how little work was being done. And one chap I remember very vaguely, because one chap was from Mongolia and was trying to learn English. And so he was really quite, he seemed like an ordinary peasant, really, and not much vice in him, not much brains either, but who could expect it? And he would explain Mongolia, and he'd look to the far horizon, say, "Mongolia, wide, wide." And then he'd look in the other direction and say, "Wide, wide." So we got the message all right. And then I remember there was another chap who wanted to know our names, you see, and so he'd say, "Nama, Nama." So you'd say, Alan, ah. "My name," he'd say, "my name is Mud." And very difficult to keep a straight face when somebody says that to you. However, that was just by the way. Life in Java was, as always, varied between times when things were fairly tolerable, times when they were not. And all the time there was this tension and a feeling of apprehension that you didn't know which way things were going, you didn't know where you were going to be moved to, and there's this feeling of uncertainty that you can never say, "Well, I'm here for the rest of the war, I'm going to relax." It was always, am I going to survive this, because something terrible is likely to happen.
You must have lost lots of people along the way. Did you through disease or...?
Yes. Amongst the amongst the people I was with, there were deaths, of course, not as many as I would have expected, because you see, the major number of deaths occurred on these terrible working parties in the very early days of the Japanese invasion of the East Indies. One of the terrible things was that a very large contingent of RAF personnel was sent to Singapore. They had only recently been conscripted in Britain. They were going to be sent out to Egypt to finish their training, instead of which the ship was diverted to Singapore in, I think, January of 1942. What was the reason for this incredible decision? I can't imagine, as these chaps were completely untrained. They were just cannon fodder. They were scooped up in Singapore and sent to the very far east of the Indonesian islands, to a terrible place called Heruku, where they had to dig an airstrip out of the coral. And the deaths there were enormous. And when eventually they came back to Java, they were, well, I mean, you only describe them now as like characters from Belsen. These poor chaps were absolutely in a terrible condition. And we realized how well off we were not to have been sent there.
Had you lost a lot of weight?
Oh, yes. In the end, I went down to about, I think, about 8 stone from about, you know, about 11. Yes, I lost a great deal of weight, you know, and so did all my friends, of course. We were all very, very skinny. But we tried to keep ourselves fit by keeping clean, you know, nevertheless, one did have these problems, and there was no, very little in the way of medical equipment at all.
Was there anyone with medical training with you?
Oh, yes, we had doctors who did their best, and sometimes you were able to do a bit of barter with a guard, and perhaps sell him, you know, somebody would sell a watch to a guard in exchange for perhaps some M&B tablets or whatever was available. But a certain amount was sometimes smuggled in. Sometimes you could do a deal with perhaps an Indonesian trader on the side, but of course it was a risk for them. In Java, I say, we were at Jakarta, and we were sent to other camps. One camp which we were sent was in the neighborhood about 20 or 30 miles away from the center of Jakarta, which was a working camp for growing vegetables on a farm. And this was called Kampong Makassar, though not, or Kampong Makassura, but Kampong Makassar. It was semi-popular amongst the troops because they said the food was better. However, it was not so popular because you had to march about 4 miles from the camp before dawn every morning and work on the fields, growing spinach and other things, and operating a simple irrigation system, and then march back by about 3 in the afternoon. So you had the rest of the day off. So it had certain advantages. There were a lot of Australians there. Well, I was sent to Kampong Makassar with some other junior officers, and when one's turn came round, one had to be in charge of a group of men of, perhaps there'd be 4 or 5 officers and 4 or 5 groups, and you'd all march off down the road. So that meant getting up at 4 in the morning to parade in the dark with a lot of bad-tempered Japanese trying to count you in the dark. And eventually, if you managed to get going, and you'd all march off. Well, one day, I was on that duty, And we marched off down the road, and after about, I think, an hour's marching, we were stopped. We fell off by the side of the road for a stand easy. At that point, an Irishman called Paddy, what else? I think he was an Irish aircraftman, came up to me and said, "Please, sir, could you tell the Jap I want to go for a shit?" Okay, I said. So we went up to the Jap in charge, who was a sergeant. Nasty looking bit of work. Saluted, and I said to him in my best pidgin Malay, "In your own mouth, piggy banjo, this man wants to go banjo," which is the Japanese word for shit. "In your own," this man. So the sergeant grunted, "Hmm." So off he went. You see. A few minutes later, he came back to me, and I thought no more about it. But when we fell in, this Japanese sergeant went berserk. I should have reported him back, which of course he's quite right, I should have done. Oh, right. So we then marched off and got to the fields where we were. At this, I was singled out with Paddy, and the men were sent off to the fields, and I was singled out, and we were attacked by him with a club, a broken piece of wood about 2 feet long, and he started beating us all over the place around the back and the head, you see, and which we had to do our best to stand up to. And I said to Paddy, you know, "Don't fall down," or whatever. So when this chap had gone tired of that, we were then put on top of a heap of manure, which was about 3 or 4 feet high. I think a large, you might say, a stack of the stuff. And we were stood onto this with our hats, with our backs bleeding quite a bit, for all the time that work went on. From about 8 in the morning, or 7 in the morning, till about 3 in the afternoon. Of course, there were times when you really felt that you were going to faint. And so, everybody, we were standing by each other. We, about 20 or 30 yards away under a canopy, were sitting the Japanese guards. And I knew that it wouldn't do to fall over, if you could, you see, because otherwise somebody would spring out and start beating again. So we encouraged each other to keep standing. And, of course, couldn't let them see us talking to each other. Until eventually, a time came to fall in and march back home. I reported, of course, to the senior officer, who was a very nice New Zealand squadron leader. But of course, as he said, you know, nothing to do about that, old boy, you see, it was one of those things, and our cuts were bathed, but they didn't have anything to put on them. My wife says she can still see the scars on my back. I don't know, I have to take a word for it. However, there was one interesting consequence. As I said, amongst the troops, the men who were prisoners, were a lot of Australians who were extremely tough, self-reliant, and altogether, you know, marvellous people to have with you. But they didn't have much time for POMs, not young POM officers who they started off by assuming would be toffee-nosed twerps, and they weren't going to yes sir, no sir to them, you see. Well, why should they? But after that particular episode, I noticed, I mean, they were never hostile to me, but they're rather indifferent. But after that particular episode, they seemed to be much more, I thought they were much more cordial, as if saying, well, you know, this POM got beaten up by the other chap, and they took it, and you know, they seemed to stand up to it all right, so perhaps they were not too bad after all. But certainly it seemed to improve relations that one had been through that bit of the mill, you know, and got through. But I'm not saying it was anything like a serious beating compared to some people that received, like my friend Sam Forward, I don't know if he told you about it, but that was a terrible one.
I'll stop you just there. Graham Allen, end of reel 6.